Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Joining me today is film historian and author, Mr. Patrick McGilligan. Welcome to FlixWise, Pat.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yes. If the name Pat McGilligan sounds familiar, it could be because you've read one of his fantastic biographies on Alfred Hitchcock or George Cukor or Robert Altman or you name it, basically. Or perhaps it sounds familiar because I specifically cited Pat's biography on Fritz Lang in our Metropolis episode. But if this is your first introduction to Patrick McGilligan, be prepared. You're about to be enlightened. No pressure, though, Pat.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm a big fan of your work, and it is an honor to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, on today's show, we're taking a break from sight and sound duty and our usual canon scrutinizing to talk about one of my personal favorite filmmakers, Mr. Orson Welles. Mr. McGilligan recently released a biography of Welles which chronicles his life prior to Citizen Kane's release. The book is called Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. And I'm very pleased that Pat is here to give listeners a sneak peek of some of the interesting history of Welles' early life. So, Pat, let's start at the reason why you decided to write this book. What about Orson Welles drew you to him, first of all, and why did you specifically decide to talk about his early life, his pre-Kane life?
Well, long answer. The shortest version of it is that I always say, honestly, it was the contract, because I only work on a book if I have an agreement with the publisher. Because for me, it's a job as well as a avocation. And my previous book about 4 years ago was a biography of Nicholas Ray, who was born in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And that gave me an opportunity to do a lot of my work in Wisconsin, where I live. I live in Milwaukee, rather than spending a lot of time out in California, which is what I had been doing for a lot of previous books over the years. And I enjoyed that. And it gave the book, Nicholas Ray also wasn't in Hollywood for very long, really, in his career. And so he ends up roaming the world after the 1950s. And it really just put a different atmosphere on the book. And when I got done with it, I was kind of thinking about what I might do next. And I realized that I lived up the road from Kenosha, Wisconsin, where Orson Welles was born in 1915. It's very nearby. And then I also realized that Orson was coming up on his 100th birthday, which is last year, but still this year in terms of the amount of time. And that 2016 would be the 75th birthday of Citizen Kane, anniversary of Citizen Kane. So I went back and I took a look at the many, many previous books about Orson and what had been said about his upbringing. And I was not very happy with what I read in terms of it, in terms of the journalism involved. And I really work, I was trained as a journalist. I work like a reporter and I work like a historian. I'm very interested in facts, chronology, sequence of events, corroborating eyewitness, contemporaneous accounts, etc. And I really got this idea in my head that I could do a whole different kind of book about Orson's early first third of his career, really, leading up to Citizen Kane, ending actually before Citizen Kane, ending with him calling action on the first take of Citizen Kane, and that this book, that this story would prefigure Citizen Kane, the story, as well as some of the stylistic elements and the characters in the story to some extent. And also that in those first 25 years, we would see the seeds of the greatness and also the seeds of all the difficulty and that his career later was to encounter. Although he encountered a lot of it before the first take of Citizen Kane anyway. I wasn't exactly sure of what I was going to find, but I knew from reading the previous books that most people had simply picked up material from earlier published accounts without spending much time in all the various places that he had lived in the Midwest, which include Kenosha, where he was born, Chicago, where he and his parents moved when he was 3 years old in 1918, Highland Park, where he spent some summers, Woodstock, where he went to prep school, Grand Detour, Illinois, where he spent summers, Lake Geneva, where he spent some summers, Madison, where he spent an entire public school year, northern Wisconsin, where he spent a very interesting summer, and Milwaukee here as well, where his mother actually entertained at the forerunner of the Milwaukee Art Museum. Mm-hmm. And so I really found great treasure troves of material in all these places.
Yeah, one of the things that I relish about all your books is how extensively they're researched, and I just marvel at all of the historical detail that you're able to cull from, I imagine, hundreds of sources. The story of the Wells family extends back essentially in your book to the beginnings of the United States. How did you go about finding all that, basically the historical record?
Yeah, well, I do the same thing no matter who I'm writing about, and that was true of whether it was Fritz Lang or Clint Eastwood or Jack Nicholson. I usually, you know, go back to where somebody was born, and then I usually go back there physically, meaning in Fritz Lang's case, I flew to Vienna, and in Jack's case, I flew to a little town in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, walk around, go to the churches, go to the local libraries, go to the local newspapers, go to the local document centers, the courthouses, et cetera. You know, I started out in doing this kind of work really in college. And in college, I was working on my first book, Jimmy Cagney, and I really did most of the book in the library. I didn't know any better, and the library at that time was pretty virgin territory. And there was no other book about, there was no book about Jimmy Cagney. So whatever I was doing was novel. Mm-hmm. In the intervening years, with all the other books I've done, I got very involved in interviewing people, especially from the Golden Age, some of whom had never been interviewed very much, and some areas of the profession that hadn't been interviewed very much, the filmmaking profession, such as screenwriters. And now, you know, when I was working on a book about someone who would have turned, you know, 100 years old in 2015, and who, when my book ends, well, the penultimate chapter is before, just before the filming of Citizen Kane is in 1941 when he's 25, that you wouldn't find anybody around who was his contemporary unless they were somewhere between the ages of 90 and 100.
Right.
And I'm always a little reluctant and wary of interviewing people that age and, you know, calling upon their memory. So for this book, I went really back into libraries and archives and courthouses and unpublished documents and electronic indices to a great extent, which are also a kind of new research tool that has become available in the last decade. Which are very helpful, were very helpful in Orson's case for chronology and sequencing things. And a lot of it is either courthouses or other indices where people hadn't necessarily thought to look. So, for example, there's quite a bit that takes place in the book even before Orson was born, even though the book begins with his birth, and there's a kind of flashback to the family tree. And there's a lot in government records, ancient government records about the paternal side of his family, which has been a kind of mysterious side, misreported in previous books, but which nowadays can be factually accessed if you really know what you're looking for and where to look for it.
Yeah. His pedigree is remarkable. The mystique of Orson Welles is one of the many things that, like, builds up that persona. But I didn't realize through him you get much through this family you see much of the development of the United States. You know, there's talk of connections to Abraham Lincoln, right?
Yes. The mother's family lived close to the Lincolns and knew the Lincolns. And as I say in the book, or as you discover in the book, Orson is not the first Wells to have shaken the hand of a president. His mother certainly did, because actually she's in the Kenosha News as having marched to the train station with the a parade of suffragists to hand over a petition to President Woodrow Wilson, whose train was idling at the Kenosha train depot waiting for her. And I say that, you know, he's not the first Wells to appear in a motion picture, because his mother and father both did. They appeared in a film that was going to be a feature set in Kenosha that was promoting air flights, early pioneering aviation flights out over Lake Michigan. One such flight of which was taken by his mother and father to cheering crowds while it was being filmed. So there's all these wonderful, wonderful surprises letting us know that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a surprise genius, that he came from very, very interesting stock, and that his mother was a great artist. She tried to be a great artist. She believed in the expression of her artistic personality in various ways, as a recitalist, sometimes a singer, sometimes as a director of stage shows, ultimately as a very, very evocative recitalist of poetry and speeches, etc., sometimes set to music. The father was at one time rumored as a consensus candidate for mayor because he was a very important businessman in Kenosha. He ran one of the brass factories. He was one of a small group of people who ran one of the most important brass factories in Kenosha at a time when brass factories were very important to the city's economy, and at the same time was a great inventor of little inventions in that area, useful for various purposes to advance both automobiles and bicycles in an era when both were really skyrocketing in sales. And I go into these patents and what they're about in the book. And he also had a political side and spoke at rallies, sometimes standing alongside his wife. So they were very, very dynamic people. But that's I would say, sort of the human component of the story, which is really fascinating. But if you take this kind of long shot view of Orson's upbringing in the Midwest and these years, which were the crucible of his talent and also his character and personality to such a great extent, the Midwest really shaped him in a lot of very important ways, because one of the things that makes Orson unique is that he could have been, I mean, a lot of things make him unique, but one thing that makes him unique is that he could have had a great career in Broadway, you know, with the snap of his fingers. And he did have a great career on Broadway, and if he had never done anything else after leaving for Hollywood in, you know, 1940, he'd be remembered, you know, he'd be in the Broadway Hall of Fame. He'd also be in the Radio Hall of Fame.
Right.
So he could have been content with either of those things. And he could have found fame and fortune in New York that way. Then he could have gone to Hollywood, and he could have had a career like any other person who wanted to be a director, which at the time was the top thing you could be in Hollywood, unless you happened to be a very powerful producer, and he could have been that.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have found fame and fortune purely as a Hollywood filmmaker. And he didn't do that, because being from the Midwest and being from Chicago, really, in his mind, largely as his second home. You know, he didn't have that same feeling about Broadway or New York as being the place where you go for your fame and fortune.
Yeah.
He didn't have that feeling about them, and he was willing to walk away from both of them, you know, from Broadway and from New York, and to become a kind of, in his own mind, an itinerant. So strangely, you know, an itinerant show business character roaming the world and picking up a ragtag troop of people wherever he went to do whatever kind of project interested him at the time, including in many places radio, TV, stage, film, vaudeville, or vaudeville-type variety shows. And so strangely, being a sort of, you know, what you would call maybe a naive Midwesterner, made him a cosmopolitan international sophisticate, willing to leave America, New York, Hollywood, and the Midwest behind.
Right.
And I write in the book about how when he grew up, there was this tremendous appreciation for the great traveling theatrical figures of the day who were willing to bring their small companies to different towns and small cities in the Midwest, Shakespearean actor managers, as they were known. And they were in the kind of twilight of their greatness at the time that Orson was a boy. And their names were spoken of in great awe in these, you know, little Midwestern places, the Sticks, you know, places like Kenosha and Milwaukee or Madison. And, you know, this is written about by in The Magnificent Ambersons as one of the characteristics of that town. And Orson grew up, you know, hearing the names of these people and knowing about them and collecting their life stories the way a later generation of boys would collect baseball cards. And his parents had the tradition of always going backstage. First of all, they went to everything. They went to symphonies, and they went to vaudeville, and they went to popular musical comedies, and they went to the most serious dramatic works, and not just in Kenosha, but they'd take the train down to Chicago, up to Milwaukee, and sometimes see things twice. And always they had a tradition of going backstage and introducing themselves to the touring artists and inviting them over for dinner or drinks. They were very, very sociable and outgoing with the people who came through wherever they were. And in a way, you know, you can think, you can put it this way, that Orson became that kind of artist, in a sense, of touring, you know, for the rest of his life around the world with his little troop of people, whoever he could get to follow him and be involved and be enthusiastic about whatever project he happened to be doing at the time. And, you know, an actor manager in the sense, in the old sense of the word, of these kind of people that he grew up revering. So this really also is a inheritance from his Midwestern upbringing that in a larger sense, you know, really, really affected the entire way he fashioned his career.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's an interesting way to reshape the narrative, which it seems now, although it's slowly being debunked, but a lot has been said about how difficult Orson was to work with, and that's the reason why he was rejected by Hollywood and take your pick of whatever career he was on. But what you're saying, in fact, is that the career path he had was essentially due to his choosing. Like, that is the ideal way to be a creative, artistic person, is to travel.
Well, I do think that, and I think it's important what you said about how I reshaped the narrative, because, you know, the narrative was reshaped for me by my research and my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I started out with, I felt a deeper empathy with him and a great admiration for him, instinctively. I didn't buy any of this, you know, he ruined his life and career after Citizen Kane kind of crap, which is, you know, one school of thought about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, of course, deal with that in the book at all, because the book only goes up to Citizen Kane, and then there's one more chapter on the last day of his life in which I kind of review his life before his death. And or use the opportunity of his death to review his life. Let's put it that way. And so I don't really deal with it. But I think in my book, up until the point of Citizen Kane, you get the sense of great joy, the great joy that he gets in trying to do all the many things he tries to do, some of which do not turn out well, and some of which are completely, you know, marginal, such as the little vaudeville tour he took just before he came out to Hollywood in 1939, because he insisted upon it and wanted to try it and had a great fun doing it. So, yeah, it does reshape the narrative. This is a guy, and he was grumpy about it for the rest of his life, people asking him about Citizen Kane as if that's the only thing he ever did, or worse, War of the Worlds, which really annoyed him, you know, because he was just tired of answering those same questions. And he was a restless guy, always moving on, not a perfectionist, not collecting mementos about, you know, or clippings about how great he was. And I think, you know, in a funny way, kind of fundamentally more modest about himself than some people give him credit for, or more realistic about himself. And he really did do many things that he got a real joy out of doing that other people never even, you know, give him credit for having done or being very important to his career, whether it be the radio work, you know, that even followed War of the Worlds, or the years that he spent as a newspaper columnist or political crusader, or the dabbling in television, or all the many, many dabblings, even the dabblings in magic. And on the last day of his life, incidentally, he's on the Merv Griffin show. He gets up on that morning and he's going to practice a magic trick because he's going to perform it for a taping of the Merv Griffin show. And Merv was an old friend of his who had had him on the show many times because Arson was such a good guest, and he would do all kinds of things, everything from Shakespeare to reciting Shakespeare to doing magic tricks to just talking. And he was a really, really great talker. And that day he was going to be on with his authorized biographer, Barbara Leeming, who had done a book that Orson, although he hadn't read it, had authorized his cooperation with. And he liked her, and he was looking forward to being on that show. And he showed up that day for work, and in the late afternoon, and he surprised Merv by saying, "You can ask me anything you want today. You know, I'm in a very good mood, whatever you want to talk about." And Merv said, "Oh, my God." Merv was very surprised. He said, "Really? I mean, you'll talk about Citizen Kane?" And so they have this very interesting kind of really, really ruleful conversation going over the highlights of Orson's life and career on this last day of his life. But one of the things that Merv Griffin asked him is whether or not he's a happy man, whether he's been a happy man. And he kind of chews on that for a moment. He says, "Well, I'll tell you that I've had joy parts of every day of my life." Mm-hmm. You know, he said, not every day, all day, but joy parts of every day of my life. And that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Considering also, I mean, and you get this in my book, especially, I think, the way it reshapes the narrative, especially considering the two crippling blows he gets as a kid. First, his mother's death when he's 9, and his father's death when he's 15.
Right.
And this would have stopped a lesser creature in his tracks. It makes him stronger. It teaches him a very personal kind of lesson, which is to go on, you know, to soldier on, to not let any of these, anything terrible that's happening to you, destroy you. And he also, I'd say the third interesting thing that happens to him that really, really forges him at this early age that also might have crippled someone else is that when his father died, the newspapers had a headline, the Chicago newspapers, because he was well known and his father was well known to all the Chicago newspaper men. The headline said he was now a rich boy because his father had died, basically a millionaire, mm-hmm. and this money was going to be put in trust until the age of 25 when he would stood to inherit a fortune. The same age, you know, incidentally, that Charles Foster Kane receives his fortune in mm-hmm. Citizen Kane. So he was told, you know, at age 15 that he was a rich boy and that, you know, the world was at his fingertips. And he honestly didn't learn that that wasn't true until he was about 25 and the money came through, by which point it had dwindled to only, you know, a few thousand dollars. But it was fundamental to his psychology that he never was a rich boy. He always had to work hard for money. He sometimes called it grocery money. You know, he was just working today for grocery money. Mm-hmm. And that money was a very important thing in his psychology vis-a-vis art, which is that money was there for the using, for the having, get it, spend it, move on.
Right. His father was a successful businessman. It seems he didn't inherit his father's business acumen.
Yeah, I mean, we all, you know, accept and throw off our parents in various ways. And so he did accept and throw off his parents in various ways. His mother never had, his mother's family went bust when she was still a young girl in music school. And so she never really had any money of her own. The father was a very prudent businessman, and I itemize his holdings at the time of his death in my book. And he was very conservative in his investments, and he was a very good businessman. And while at the same time, that wasn't something that Orson ever had a chance to do.
Yeah.
You know, much less had the slightest inclination to do. And it's almost psychological with him that throughout his life, he's not a great speller, which is, you know, a kind of sort of fundamental indication of like your let's say literary intelligence. He just he blew that off. He wasn't interested in being a perfect speller, and he was very bad at arithmetic and math and anything to do with numbers, including budgets.
Yeah.
And he refused to be good at that. And you see this even with Citizen Kane, but you see it in the budget for the RKO budgets that were handed to him. You see it in the Mercury budgets, which were not all his fault, but which were chaotic. But he was not good at budgets, and he didn't pretend to be. He took the money he had for anything, whatever that project was, and then he spent all the money.
Yeah.
And then he spent a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, that's what it's
for. He started over again, either begging for money or moving on to the next project.
Yeah, yeah. So much has been said about Orson Welles' genius. And indeed, when he was a young child, he was dubbed a genius in the local newspaper, even in his teenage years, tremendous success on the stage. But how much of that was actual intelligence? Obviously, goes without saying, he was a very, very intelligent guy. But throughout the book, as I was reading it, I was like, so much of this is, it almost seems like he was destined to be this figure.
I'm glad you asked that book that question. The subtitle of the book is The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane, but it really fits the book for a couple of reasons, and it fits Orson's career for a couple of reasons. Genius, you know, let me say that you see in the book that he's actually tested for genius as a kid, and he tests really high.
Mm-hmm.
That he really had a remarkable intellect and ability, and a precocious ability to soak things up long before in age or years he was expected to know and do certain things. So there were many ways in which people were whispering the word genius in his ears when he was a kid, and when that might be quite understandable that you would meet him and also say, wow, this kid is a genius. In fact, when he does his very first newspaper interview, which is in the winter of 1926 when he's living in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's photographed as a kind of chubby chipmunk kid wearing an ascot, and he extemporizes a long poem for the newspaper. There's the long interview with him with a seasoned reporter the seasoned reporter's jaw is dropping and saying every word except genius that comes to his mind, saying that this kid is just really remarkable. So, and then that's picked up by the Woodstock newspapers and by the Chicago newspapers while he's still a teenager, by hardened, you know, characters meeting him, some of them who knew him privately through his parents even before they were writing about him, but who nonetheless were really impressed by this kid's genius. And he himself, you know, rarely in interviews comments on the word genius except self-deprecatingly and quite amusingly. But it was a tag that he got early on. You know, he was called the Wonderkin and the Kid Wonder of Broadway and, you know, the new boy and town and the boy genius, all of this. And so it was great, you know, it was a great boon in the sense that it elevated him above other people and called the attention of the public to him. And at the same time, it became this kind of cross he had to bear for the rest of his life. Well, he was a kid genius, but then what happened? You know, he grew up and he was no longer such a genius anymore. And so he began to be even more disparaging about it when asked about it in interviews. But there was no doubt an element of genius, and genius can be described many different ways. But there was no doubt a recognizable genius, you know, when people met him, strangers, but also journalists. And when also it's important to say when the public saw some of the things he did early in his career, you know, like his Voodoo Macbeth or his Julius Caesar on stage or War of the Worlds and other really magnificent radio productions, that they were seeing from a very young talent a real striking and trailblazing new kind of artistry, both in radio and on stage. So people were using that word kind of liberally when he was very young. Then he comes to Hollywood with, you know, a contract as a producer, writer, director, and star of his first film, and the columnists, you know, go to town on the word genius because they are a little bit affronted.
Right.
You know, that young kid has come to town with all this power. But Orson, on his last day of life, when he's giving this interview to Merv, and it's being taped for later broadcast, he also talks about how he was had a lot of luck in his career, and that luck really had a lot to do with why he did certain things and how certain things turned out. And, you know, for example, the case of Citizen Kane involves a lot of fortuitous circumstance, including a producer and head of the studio, George Schaefer, who was the unsung hero of the film because he always said yes to Orson when his back was against the wall and everybody was urging him to say no. So Orson said, and I think this is part of his inherent, you know, really fundamental modesty in talking to Merv. He said, I had a lot of luck. And he meant a lot of bad luck. And sometimes it was very bad luck. And, you know, his parents' deaths were certainly luck or fate of a certain really terrible kind. But he also said a lot of good luck, you know, good luck meeting John Houseman and having him as a partner for the Mercury Theater, good luck in George Schaefer, good luck in meeting people, you know, along the way, you know, people like Joseph Cotten and Agnes Moorehead, and he begins to collect this informal troupe around himself in 1935, and some of them follow him or are with him in productions and projects through to the end of his life. So he meant it. You know, there was bad luck and there was good luck, as well as the genius.
Right, yeah, it seems that time after time, it's Orson taking these big leaps and counting on someone being there to catch him. And throughout, at least in these early years, it seems like someone is always there.
Yeah, or even when he has tremendous flops or big, big snafus, the last, you know, Mercury Theater production, per se, Five Kings, which completely falls apart. Or even the vaudeville tour that he does right before coming out to Hollywood, which was a real kind of quixotic gesture where he got on stage in a turban and they did a kind of crazy old melodrama in which all the stage effects went really, you know, awry
right
in front of the audience, and it was almost, you know, semi-comical. He enjoyed a great pratfall. He enjoyed a great disaster. He would roar at, you know, in anger, quickly followed by the roar of laughter at himself. And, you know, he almost had to have that in order to take these great risks. So he wasn't always counting on being caught or saved. He was willing to take the high dive. By the way, you see this in his mother, and you see this in some of the stories about his mother and her performances in the book, that she was exactly, and undoubtedly that was bred into his character, this willingness to do or try anything in public for money, for grocery money, or for the fun of it, or because there seemed no other option at the time, and to do it with a sort of brave, you know, defiant laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned Joseph Cotten and Agnes Moorehead, and the story, you tell very briefly the story of Agnes Moorehead's first encounter with Orson, and that was one of my favorite details from the book, and I was hoping you could maybe tell the listeners how they ended up meeting.
Yeah, well, you know, when I say luck and genius, luck is kind of interchangeable with the word fate for some people, and it did seem that Orson was fated to meet a lot of people in his early life that either were already famous, you know, that he just happened to, like, you know, open the door and say, hey, there's Harry Houdini, nice to meet you.
Right.
This kind of thing happened to him with such regularity, it was rather astonishing. But when you went back and fact-checked everything, which was part of what I was doing, you saw that these things that he always talked about really did happen. And on one of his early trips to New York, because his father liked to take him, his father had a rather bitter near divorce with the mother, and then they separated, and then even while the mother was still alive, but then soon after she died as well, there became this regular annual, at least once annually, trip to New York to see shows and plays and things. And after his mother died, the parenting of Orson was kind of shared by his father and by this doctor, Dr. Maurice Bernstein, who later becomes Orson's guardian, who had become the doctor for every member of the family in turn, for different problems for each member of the family, the older brother, then the mother, then the father, and then finally, you know, Orson himself. They all take a little trip to New York, and the father takes them off to see Houdini, who the father knew. Father was a big magic fan and not aficionado. And then the doctor, you know, took him to see. The doctor was a big classical arts aficionado, which is why he was so enamored of Orson's mother. Because she was a classical musician and artist. He took Orson to see Stravinsky and to meet Stravinsky in his American debut. And later on, they go back to the Hotel Waldorf, and you know, there's this young actress there who also has a Wisconsin connection named Agnes Moorhead with her mother, and she recalls vividly, you know, this then, nine going on 10-year-old boy discoursing intelligently on the you know, the classical symphony that he had heard that evening and on Stravinsky. And it isn't until, you know, X number of years later, about 1935 or 1936, when she re-encounters him in the corridors of radio shows, that she realizes that this was Orson Welles. So he meets the woman who's going to play the fictional mother of Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane the same year that his mother dies.
Yeah.
And he really, I mean, the Mercury Theater troupe is a really interesting group of people that he begins to collect around him. And the circumstances of most of the meetings are quite hilarious. The one with Agnes Moorhead is more serious, but in Joseph Cotten's case, that takes place in the mid-1930s when both of them are relatively unknown performers. Orson was completely unknown. Joseph Cotten had been getting a little bit of work, but they're both doing a radio show that all the unemployed or underemployed actors in Hollywood did. And Orson and Joseph Cotten were on a show together and reading the script. And Orson was a big joker and was making fun of the dialogue in a kind of double entendre way. And they both fell over laughing and couldn't get a straight face back together, really annoying their producer so that everybody else in the cast started falling over laughing too. And I go into who else was in the room and some of the others also turn up in the Mercury Theater and Citizen Kane later. But Orson and Joseph Cotten almost from that moment become like surrogate brothers. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Cotten was this, you know, handsome, debonair, let nothing ruffle him, ladies' man, kind of a scamp. And he just thought Orson was hilarious and brilliant. And I think until the day that Orson died, he thought Orson was hilarious and brilliant. And he became his kind of alter ego in films. And, you know, the part of Jed Leland was written for him in Citizen Kane. But Joseph Cotten became really, you know, a kind of brother soldier in his army, you know, for the rest of Orson's life and career. They were really, really good friends.
Yeah. You mentioned Dr. Maurice Bernstein, and there's just a whole host of surrogate fathers that sort of course through Orson's youth. And one of the most significant ones is Roger Hill, who was Orson's teacher / mentor at the Todd School. And you can tell us a little bit more about Roger Hill and the role that he played in Orson's artistic development.
Yeah, the Todd School was the prep school that Orson ends up going to in about fall of 1927, maybe. Mm-hmm. At a point in time in which his father and Dr. Bernstein had kind of failed in their attempt to send him to Chicago public school first, then a Madison public school, Madison, Wisconsin, and finally decided to send him off to this first-class prep school, the Todd School in Woodstock, Illinois, which is, you know, maybe about an hour, and by train then from Chicago. And it was being run by Roger Hill's father. It was being run according to a traditional way of doing a prep school at that time, which included some military regimen and a lot of Christian regimen. And Roger Hill was coming up to take over the school. But one thing he was doing at the time under his father was he was serving as athletic director. But he only agreed to serve as athletic director if he could also take over all the school plays and direct them and write many of them. With the musical director at the time, who also figures into the story in an interesting way because he ends up being probably the first person to hand Orson a movie camera or to film Orson on film. But anyway, Roger Hill was really a frustrated athletic director. He was really a Renaissance character who like Orson, knew Shakespeare backwards and forwards and knew all poetry and great speeches and really, really had an aesthetic spirit and was interested in the arts, but he had been stuck as athletic director. And I go into the book how Orson's arrival at the Todd School at almost the moment in time when Roger is beginning to ascend to take over the school really changes, you know, everything. It changes the school. It changes Roger Hill and allows him to come out as a personality and to be more artistic and a more free-spirited headmaster. And it is a place then where Orson really begins to blossom and come into his own and take over all of the school entertainments in various ways, behind the scenes, writing them, directing them, performing in them, etc. But he and Roger Hill really had such a deep kinship. It became a friendship almost right away, even though there was a almost a father-son difference in ages between them. And Orson would turn up in the bedroom with the Mr. and Mrs. Hill at nighttime, you know, when they were trying to go to bed. They had their own kids, and they were trying to wind up the day, and he'd just be sitting on the edge of the bed talking. And they end up kind of almost adopting him, but certainly adopting him spiritually and accepting him as a permanent member of their life, really indulging him in many ways, in many very good ways at the Todd School, allowing him to be Orson Welles, which actually becomes kind of the credo of the school under Roger Hill eventually, which is to allow every boy to become himself and to explore himself and express himself. And then Roger Hill becomes, throughout Orson's life, a great rock of sympathy and advice and sometimes collaboration on many, many interesting things together, usually with Roger Hill trying to do as little as possible in order to just get Orson going and then back out, because Orson was a self-starter, and all you really had to do was get him started and then kind of back out of the room and let him finish. All the way up through to the end of their lives, very, very deep, intimate friends. And
Orson got so much positive reinforcement at such a young age, but also, we've talked about, there were also a number of setbacks. But was there a singular moment, in your opinion, where all the years of toiling and writing and creating and pushing and tenacity sort of coalesced into a real moment of success where Orson felt like, I've finally done it, I've achieved my goals?
I don't think so, because I don't think he would ever achieve his goals. Because his goals were to keep going and doing it, doing more and doing better, you know. But there are many moments in his early career where he felt he had arrived, or where some really, really great, he got some really, really great affirmation of his talent that really reinforced his confidence and his abilities to do things at an early age. You know, going to Ireland when he had gotten out of prep school, and then talking his way into a job doing leads on the Dublin stage of the Gate Theatre, that was a tremendous triumph. And he felt, you know, as if he had arrived. He later said, you know, I'd started out my career on this high note and everything was downhill after that, because there were many, it was more of a roller coaster ride. There were moments that were such heights for him. You know, he said Voodoo Macbeth, you know, he felt like the king every day, you know, coming to work. Mm-hmm. When he had done Voodoo Macbeth and was acclaimed for the first time in the New York Press as the great, you know, visionary of Broadway's future, of theater's future. And then, you know, to a certain extent, War of the Worlds, when he transformed radio and catapulted his name onto, not, you know, off the theater and show business pages, onto the front pages and editorial pages. And, you know, the book really works up to Citizen Kane and him calling action on the first take. And you might say, or you might be tempted to say, well, that's the first, you know, climax and real climax and affirmation of his talent that could have given him great satisfaction. I have no doubt that he had great satisfaction, but he never got that great triumph in the way that he should have, because William Randolph Hearst's minions, you know, attacked and subverted the picture and kept it from being widely released or widely successful financially, and it even hurt it, you know, in terms of the Academy Awards and what recognition it might have received in Hollywood. Even though it did well enough that we all remember it today and think of it as probably the greatest film of all time, certainly one of the greatest films of all time, and the Sight and Sound poll and other polls keep reinforcing this decade after decade. So he got a lot of satisfaction from that, but he never really had, you know, he never really had what you're talking about. And I think if he would have had it, he wouldn't have, he would have gone past it really quick.
Yeah, because move right on.
Wasn't, again, fame and fortune, the kind of thing that, you know, you and I would have gone to bed saying, well, that was a good day, and now I can take a year off, or,
yeah,
you know, I can take a few weeks off. He was not doing that. You know, he had to be told in 1939, when Five Kings was nearly killing him, by his doctor to take, you know, a few days off.
Right.
And so he had, whenever there was, I think maybe he knew this as from his childhood and from these terrible events with his parents. He knew that around the corner of every great success is a waiting catastrophe.
Right, right, yeah. Just before we wrap up, I just want to read one passage from your book. It's a letter from Dr. Bernstein to Orson, who, as we discussed, Dr. Bernstein was one of Orson's surrogate parents and ultimately became the executor of his trust. But he was sort of a mixed bag. His presence in Orson's life wasn't always welcome. But he did write this one poignant letter to Orson after he lost a tournament, I guess, and it's like a theater competition called the Goodman Tournament.
Very important competition from the point of view of the prep school.
Yeah,
which really badly wanted the trophy as the best, you know, prep school drama group
in
Chicago area.
Yeah, and that was the most important thing at that moment. But he wrote this, I think, poignant letter, and I'll just read it really quickly. Look at all the great works of art that slumbered without being recognized, and so let this be a lesson to you. There will be times in your life when you will meet up with the same situation. Someday when you will look back upon this disappointment as having just been a passing experience. We must learn to accept disappointments and profit by them. Do you think that was a lesson that Orson took to heart?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a very, very interesting letter. And I think it attests to Dr. Bernstein's goodness and his wisdom and his ultimate nurturing intelligence where Orson was concerned. and saying kind of what we've been saying before you read the letter, which is don't let it bother you. They're not always going to recognize what you do as great, but I think you're great, Orson.
Yeah.
That's what Dr. Bernstein is saying. And he says it very, very beautifully. And Orson's, as I said, his fortune, you know, evaporated or whistled in the wind. And he, later in life, when he was sort of grumpy and morose, he worried that Dr. Bernstein had kind of pirated it away in some way. I don't find any great evidence for it, but I do find evidence in that letter and in the 15 years between 1930, well, not 15, but the years between 1930 and the start of Citizen Kane before Orson gets his pittance that remains of his great trust fund. I find Dr. Bernstein to be a stalwart character, nurturing, encouraging, and cheerleading Orson, not always in, as you say, not always in a way that you would welcome.
Yeah.
And he was, I say in the book, a kind of a Budinsky and a bumbling kind of a guy in many ways. And he didn't have children. He was a childless character, and I don't think he really understood children. And it was very hard to understand and cope with Orson at many times because he was a very demanding personality. But I think Dr. Bernstein did his best, and that letter is great evidence of it because that was really, really well-needed consolation and advice at the time that he gave it.
Yeah, and I think sage advice for all people starting out on creative journeys, creative paths, any creative endeavor.
I have no doubt that he was parroting the mother's words because there's even a reference in there to, in the longer letter that's quoted in the book, to a poet that the mother loved. And I have no doubt that Dr. Bernstein was always trying to do, you know, what he thought the parents might have done, but especially the mother whom he adored. And so it really, I mean, that you see that in Orson's behavior, determined artistic behavior, admirable artistic behavior throughout the rest of his life and career, of following that advice and wisdom of don't let it get you down permanently. Get up, keep going. Try the next thing.
All right. All right. Well, that seems like a pretty good place to end this interview.
Good.
Good. Was there anything else that you wanted to add before we sign off?
No, but it's, I would tell anybody who's listening, it's a long book. It's 800 pages, but I think it should read like an adventure story, with almost an Indiana Jones type character questing after his rosebud, because it's a very exciting and very uplifting story to see this guy really, really questing after art in a very buoyant way early in his career.
And that's The Way We Frame It, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, if you have any thoughts on today's show, you can come leave us a comment on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/FlixWise. And if you want to comment gush about Orson Welles with me, follow me on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes or Stitcher. Let the big podcatchers know how much you dig our little podcast. On our next show, we're back on Sight and Sound duty. Check back on Facebook and Twitter for updates. Until then, Pat, it was such a pleasure having you on the show.
Good. I'm glad we did it, Pauline, after all that, like, trying to do it.
I know, back and forth, always. And but if people want to purchase a copy of Young Orson, they should look online, in bookstores.
Yeah. Are you in Los Angeles? I forget.
I am.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Book Soup and, you know, places like that have it.
Yeah.
It's online. It's pretty available. I mean, I don't think stores carry great numbers because it's so expensive, so they just carry a few. But,
right.
You know, people should be able to find it in L.A. particularly.
Yeah, there's a bookstore in downtown L.A. called The Last Bookstore, and I did see a copy there. So check your local bookstores.
Good.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, good.
Well,
Pauline, and we'll do it again.
All right, sounds good. And wait, we got to sign off officially. You ready? I'm Lady P, and this has been a FlixWise production.